Thank you for the introduction. It's my pleasure to give like lecture two of the sequence and realities. Now, Chong already did an excellent job yesterday to introduce what people have been doing in the last few years, studying realities in 2+1 dimensions, maybe some applications to condensed matter problems. What I wanted to do is actually go back and tell you a lot of things people have done in the 90s. And I hope this gives you some intuition where particle physicists come from, because this is when we first ran into all these interesting realities, when we learned how to deal with them. And many of the tools people are applying these days in order to check realities, in order to find realities, they have their precursor back in this old stuff from the 90s. So I hope I can share sort of the insights from a particle physicist of how we think about realities, which is a lot of this is rooted in the 90s. I probably won't have much time in the end to comment how this connects to what people have been doing in three dimensions recently. You know, ask me this afternoon, or kind of, I hope it should become obvious that a lot of the things I'm saying are kind of exactly the same things that people are doing these days when they're going to study dualities. Just now, two warnings. One warning is I'm going to at some point, I try to be very explicit about all the calculations I'm doing, but sometimes I appeal to Suzy magic, and that will just be no proof. I have no time to explain supersymmetry at all. Some things will just be true because of supersymmetry, and I'll try to avoid this as much as possible, but every now and then it's impossible to avoid saying this. The other thing I wanted to mention, right, if you talk about realities in the 90s, they pretty much have been invented, all of them, by Seiberg plus X. Sometimes X was the empty set. So I'm not sure if Nadi is there or not, but no, he has this tendency of telling me every time I say something wrong. So he's right, I'm wrong. If you have any difficult questions, ask him directly. I'm just basically telling you all the great things he's been doing in the 90s. Okay. So without any further ado, let me get started. Right. So. The first example I wanted to talk with you about is going to be T-duality in 1+1 dimensions. Let me call this D=2. Just a reminder, when a particle physicist says D=2, really I mean 1+1, and that means one space, one time. Because I think when we meet as communities, this is usually the first source of miscommunication, that what I call 2, you call 1. But so this is going to be a duality in 1+1 dimensions. And if you want, and I'll explain this a little bit in more detail later, this is basically an example of something one could also understand as particle vortex duality. So when we talk about a duality, what is a duality really all about? This is like a few more words as motivation, right? If I think of an ordinary integral, say I want to calculate a function, which, an integral which I call z, and you have some integral that goes from minus infinity to infinity, and say this could be some nice Gaussian integral, something like minus x squared over a. So this is something we would call a free theory. Because in quantum field theory, quantum mechanics, anything that's quadratic is considered to not have any interactions. It's a plastic Gaussian integral. If you're silly, you could do something like this, where you kind of introduce a change of variables, say you call x being y plus y squared. And then you would be able to rewrite this same integral as some integral dy from minus infinity to infinity. It might not even be right. Didn't seem. Integral dy of 1+2y e to the minus y plus y squared over a. Right? And this looks horribly interacting because it's no longer quadratic. Right? This is essentially what the duality is in the end going to be all about. We are calculating integrals, pass integrals this time, integrals over all field configuration rather than integrals over just one number. But now if I want to make a pass integral rigorous, I would discretize it, put it on a lattice, it becomes just a bunch of ordinary integrals. And sometimes it's not obvious that if you were only using the right variables, it's just some Gaussian integral. But really what we're looking for is we're trying to look for the right variables in which to do the integral, so that things look manifest, obvious to us. Right? And different dualities relate are basically just choosing different integration variables for doing your pass integral. This all becomes much more exciting when you're actually talking about pass integrals, right? Because in physics, when you're doing a pass integral, then basically your integration variable is the analog of the degrees of freedom that you want to study. So saying you're using the right integration variable is really saying, well, if I wanted to study nuclear physics, I can write it as an integral over gluons and quarks, But in the end, what I see is baryon and mesons. Maybe if I want to study low energy properties, it would have been better to use baryons and mesons as my integration variables. So, now, the simple fact of changing integration variables from the point of view of how you interpret the theory is really just saying, what are the effective degrees of freedom that I can actually observe? Usually when you have a theory where there's some quasi-particles that weakly interact, those are the right integration variables. And duality is all about finding the right integration variables that make physics sort of simple. Right. So let's get going on this example of T-duality. Right. So here I'm studying 1+1 dimensions and my action and my particle. So I want to calculate my C is going to be some particle over some field which I call phi, and then I have an e to the minus s. So that's a Euclidean setting. So 1+1 literally got replaced by 2. And I'm going to comment a little bit on the Lorentzian setting eventually. And I have an action, which is given by 1 over 4 pi, then I have an integral over d to x. And then I have a parameter r sitting here, r squared over 2 pi times d phi squared. If your string theory is basically what I'm doing, I'm setting alpha prime equals to 2. You never heard about alpha prime, don't worry. That's my action. So there's this parameter r. Right? You might wonder, why is there an r here? Can't I just scale this away? I'm used to having a kinetic term with a prefactor of 1/2. And the reason I put this R there is because what I want to study is a compact boson. Chong talked about compact bosons the other day and there were some questions in the chats. So a compact boson is one that has an identification, right? This scalar is only evaluated on a circle. You can think of it as being like a phase of maybe some complex scalar field. It's a real scalar field, but it only takes values between 0 and 2 pi. Once the scalar field hits 2 pi, I'm back to where I started. And no, you could get rid of this factor R in the action, but then it would appear in my identification for the scalar phi. So one way or another, there's a parameter R there, which is sort of the radius that my scalar takes. Right? If I were to put in 1/2 in my kinetic term, the scalar goes is identified by 2 pi R. Here we are choosing to say the scalar has a period of 2 pi, but then R appears explicitly in the action. So what's new about having a compact scalar? What's new is that a compact scalar can have non-trivial winding modes. Right? If I label my space by x and t, and say I have x living on the circle, so x itself gets identified by x plus 2 pi. So my theory is kind of living on a cylinder, x is a circle, time propagates from minus infinity to infinity. Then you see we can have configuration where if I go around the spatial circle of my space-time, my scalar field usually, I would say, has to come back to itself, right? That's sort of what it means to live on a circle. If I go around the circle, I'm back to where I started. So my field got to be single valued, has to go back to where I used to be. But because it's a compact scalar field, I can add some integer times 2 pi. So this omega has to be an integer. And this is called a winding number. And I give you a nice geometric picture of what this corresponds to, either from the particle vortex point of view or the string theory point of view in a second. But this is the new thing that happens if I have compact scalars. Compact scalars can have non-trivial winding when you go around a circle because I don't have to go back to myself. I can come back to myself up to multiple of 2 pi. All right, so what are the properties of this theory? Let's study the spectrum a little bit. Right, and but what I want to look at, like if I look at the equations of motion, it's a free scalar field, right? Clearly, the solution is like the second derivative of the thing going to vanish, or no box on it going to vanish. So I can have things that are linear in time. I can have things that are linear in space. This was not an N, it was a W. Okay. And then I can have some sort of oscillating modes. And let's forget about those for now, right? So these are sort of the zero modes, is this what people sometimes refer to? Because if I hit them with a second derivative, they just get annihilated completely. And so if I want to calculate the notion of an energy, I know that these momentum modes in quantum mechanics, because I'm living on a circle, they're going to be quantized in n over r's. This is just if I wanted to write down the wave function that actually corresponds to this mode. It's like a particle in a box. The wave function has to be periodic. But it has to be like, you know, for me to be have consistent with the periodic boundary condition in the x direction, the allowed momenta are going to be quantized. And if you calculate the energies that would come with this. get sort of, this is relativistic theory, right? I get something that's linear momentum, I get an N over R. But then if I look at my winding modes, right? If I take the winding modes that's linear in X, then I would get an energy that goes like omega R over 2. And this is literally just the classic energy that my scalar field has a has a constant gradient, and I integrate that constant gradient around the circle, and then I get omega R equals to 2. So if I just look at this, then you see that if I change R to 2 over R, at the same time exchange the momentum quantum number with the winding quantum number, then I get back the same spectrum. The same spectrum of zero modes. And that's my T-duality. There's a statement that for the free scalar field, if I compactify it at the radius R, that's the same as compactifying at the radius 2 over R. And at this level, this looks like a rather trivial statement, but I'm gonna make a big deal about it, out of this, and we're gonna use some tools in order to, you know, understand this in a very quantitative way. And the same tools then can be applied to more interesting dualities as well. Yeah. Let me draw a picture for you how you can understand this, right? So if I think of, right, so my scalar field phi, this was a compact scalar. Right, so the way I can think of this, you can think of this as being a coordinate in some target space. And then you can think of phi as a function of x and t. You can kind of think of this as being like, you know, describing the embedding of a string into this target space. Right? If I write down, if I wanted to tell you here's a string and I label its, you know, direction by x and time as it propagates along by t, and I wanted to know where in some space-time is the string is a function of x and t, this is exactly the data I would have to write down for you. I have to tell you the position of each point of the string at every instant in time. So right now my target space is one-dimensional. Let's just imagine there's some other coordinates which you might as well call y. So then my target space looks something like this, right? So there's my phi direction is the circle direction that you want to keep track of. And then these y's would be other scalars. Instead of just studying one scalar, I study many scalars. That's what literally string theory would look like. If this were like the bosonic string, there would be 25 of those y's and then my one phi. But just so I can draw pictures, let's imagine we have some more scalars. It's the phi scalar that I care about. Right, this momentum mode would correspond to something where my string essentially shrank to a point and is moving with some fixed momentum p around that internal circle. If my string had some finite size, that would say I also turned on some of these oscillator modes. Right? You can all imagine this when I solve the wave equation for field living on a string, I have some sort of oscillator modes and they correspond to the string actually vibrating. Right? That's what violin strings do. The more it vibrates, the more excited it gets. You know, the bigger its oscillation will be. But if it's not oscillating at all, that string shrank to a point, but that point can still move around that circle. That's what this momentum mode was. Then what does a winding mode like look like? No, winding mode now literally looks like a winding mode. The thing that I wrote down would be a string that's sort of winding around its circle exactly once. Right? And if I note in addition turn on oscillators, it can also wobble around. But a winding mode is something that wraps around that circle. So this T-duality takes a small circle into a big circle, a small circle into a big circle, and exchanges winding and momentum. So whether you move around a big circle, that's the same as winding around a small circle and the other way around. And you can easily see that T-duality extends to the oscillator sector as well. You just want to focus on the spectrum, but let me not study that spectrum. I want to derive T-duality as a personal identity because that's sort of the tools that I was trying to convey to you. So let me not talk more about the spectrum. Let's move on and try to understand this as a cosmical identity. But before that, I wanted to say something, how this relates to particle vortex duality, just to kind of make sure that you understand I'm not just in string theory land, this is actually relevant for condensed matter physics too. Right? So if I'm literally sitting on R2, I study the Euclidean setting, then a winding mode, right? So I have phi can wind around infinity. So it can wind around infinity. So if you want to kind of indicate like the phi by some sort of a direction on the unit circle, you can write down a field configuration for phi, which does something like this. So this would be in the Euclidean setting, a non-trivial winding mode. So if I said this omega equals to 1, I have one winding, that would correspond to a field configuration where my phase of phi winds around the origin in a non-trivial way. That's exactly the sort of thing that you would call a vortex. Right? On a lattice, this would be a well-defined configuration, something you want to include in your Pearson integral. Right? This configuration is singular in the continuum limit. So if you study a genuine continuum quantum field, so you do not want to include that configuration in your Pearson integral. I think this is sometimes refer to whether you have like a compact U1 or non-compact U1 when you had like if this were a gauge field. But when I say it's a compact scale, I literally meant that it has this 2 pi periodicity. And as a continuum field theory on R2, you would not want to include those vortices. But if you want, you can go ahead and say, let me remove the origin. Right? Then this is a perfectly fine configuration. And then basically I'm back on the cylinder, right? If I remove the origin, then this looks again like a cylinder. And then we want to keep the vortex. And then the thing that I call T duality all along in the end will be a particle vortex duality because it exchanged the winding with a particle, right? The thing that I called momentum before, that's just an ordinary particle excitations. Yes, this winding would be from that point of view of a Euclidean quantum field theory on R2 with the origin removed. That would be the vortex that I want to study. So this T-duality you can understand as particle vortex duality, but I want to talk about it as T-duality for the rest of the lecture. Okay, so now let's do a Pearson integral derivation. Right, so the basic idea of how to derive this I want to do the following, right? We started out with a Pearson integral, which is an integral over this d phi with some action that depends on phi. And essentially what I want to do is I want to introduce some dummy variable d phi tilde with an action which is a function of phi and phi tilde. And this will be arranged in such a way that if I do the integral over phi tilde, I'm back to where I started, right? Clearly this hasn't done anything interesting. You just arranged a new integral which by construction gives me back the old theory that you started with. But now if you look at this, order of integration doesn't matter. You can go back in and do the phi integral first and you end up with some new action, which depends on the dual variable. And my claim is that we can understand T-duality this way quite easily. I'm actually gonna do something slightly more complicated. Instead of introducing one dummy field, I'm gonna introduce two dummy fields. But if you look at the lecture note of Carl Turner's that I posted, he gives you the version with only one dummy field. I'll explain to you in a second why I will do the version with two dummy fields. But this is the basic idea of how you can kind of, for example, derive something like T-duality directly at the level of a Pearson integral. I should say, when I talk about 90s, this will mostly be the later part of my talk. This stuff is even older than the 90s. So what we're going to do is like the tool that we're going to use is we're going to exploit the shift symmetry in the system. And what does the shift symmetry have to do with duality? You'll wait till I'm done, then you'll see this was a really good thing to do. But for now, just let's know. This is going to be a cookbook. You follow the recipe, in the end comes out some really yummy duality. But for now, let's just not think about why I'm doing this. We go into the why questions, hopefully, what's the end of the problem. So my system has a shift symmetry where I can just phi and take it to phi plus constant. There was only d phi in my action. Clearly, shifting phi by a constant does not change my action at all. So what I want to do first, I want to gauge this symmetry. Right? So basically what I'm going to do is whenever I see my derivative d mu phi, I'm going to replace this with some covariant derivative d mu phi where I couple my scalar field to a gauge field. And now I shifted, right? I gauge this shift symmetry, right? When I take phi goes to phi plus the C now can depend on X and T. I can compensate this by having A mu eat up that derivative. Okay. So this is the standard procedure how to gauge a theory, right? This seems to have changed the theory. I now have a new field, right? There's an A mu here, right? Instead of describing a theory with one scalar, I describe to you a theory with a scalar and a gauge field. What am I doing? Well, I should make sure that A doesn't have any dynamic, no, A doesn't contribute anything, right? I should make sure that A is equal to zero, then I'm back to where I started. So how am I gonna do this? Basically what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna replace my personal over d phi, we're gonna replace by a personal d phi, d a mu. A mu is not one of my dynamical fields, but then I'm gonna include a delta function in which I'm gonna insist that my field strength of A is equal to zero, which is almost what I wanted. And the difference between almost and exactly what I wanted would actually be quite important. So bear with me if you say, you only wanted A to be zero, why do you say, no, you want A to be zero, but now you're trying the field strength to be zero. That's sometimes the same, but not really always. Well, let's talk about this in a second. But for now, let's study the thing on flat space where the only way to get the field strength equals to zero is up to gauge transformations that A is actually zero. And when I do an integral d A mu, this is really modded out by gauge transformation. Right at the bottom of my screen. That's supposed to be the same gauge. Right, so I want to make sure that my field strength is zero, which should imply A is zero unless there's something going on with topology. And then what we're going to do is we're going to, I write this on the next screen. So, I want to write this integral d phi dA times the delta of f mu nu is equal to zero. We're going to write the delta function itself as some personal, right? We're going to write as an integral d phi dA, and then I introduce some Lagrange multiplier, which for now I call lambda, and then I have to include an e to the I over 2 pi integral of lambda, and then the field strength, so epsilon mu nu, e mu. And this I here is really important, right? The delta function, the Fourier transform of a delta function is an e to the I xp, right? So in Euclidean setting, this is basically telling me I have an I in the action. In the Lorentzian setting, this I is automatic. The action is real. So if you wonder of why is it okay to put I into the action, these topological terms, things with epsilons, always have I's in the Euclidean setting, because in the Lorentzian setting, I want actions that are nice and real, where I can interpret things as energies and propagating forward in time. In the Euclidean setting, well, what's the right way of putting I? Is it so that when I go to Lorentzian signatures, there are no I's in the actions? Here we need an I explicitly in this term that's sitting up in the exponential, and therefore I would call it an action. Okay, so we have f mu nu equals to zero ensured by putting in this extra delta function. So this is telling me immediately that A mu is equal to zero up to gauge transformation on R2. Right. What about the cylinder, right? We were very interested in studying the theory on the cylinder, or maybe since I'm doing a Euclidean setting, even on the torus. And then we have new gauge invariant quantities, something like taking an integral along a closed loop of dx mu, A mu, along a closed loop. And if I'm, say, doing this on the torus, I can have two different closed loops. So I can have these A cycles and the B cycles. So if I do this in one of the cycles, A or B, this gives me a new gauge invariant parameter, theta A. So even if F is equals to zero, I make sure that F is equals to zero by putting the delta function into my personal. That doesn't mean A has to be zero, right? The theta can be non-zero. I can have a non-trivial Wilson line of my gauge field around the torus, even if I made sure that my field strength is equal to zero. So here comes the important claim. How can I fix this? My claim is if I choose that this lambda, my Lagrange multiplier, that thing that enforces that F vanishes, if lambda is periodic, that will ensure that the theta A's are equal. So Well, like once multiplier was just some dump wheel field itself, because I wanted to ensure that f at every x and t is equal to zero, it was valued from minus infinity to infinity. But now my claim is if I make lambda a periodic field as well, something that has a periodic identification, then we'll actually end up with a theory where all these extra gauge invariant parameters, all these Wilson lines around the non-contractible cycles, they all have to vanish as well, so that setting f equals to zero is really enough to make sure that a is equals to zero, so that my new theory is actually the same as the old theory. But right now we're just working really, really hard to get a theory which is just a free scalar in disguise. And this will in the end tell me that this lambda, this Lagrange multiplier, in fact should be identified with the dual scalar, right? We want to in the end get a new scalar out, something that's also compact, and that's going to be this lambda. Well, how does this work? Well, if you look at the action, right, this term in the action that I had on my last slide, let me write it again, right? If I have in the action, there's like a bunch of terms, but the one term that I had was this integral of I over 2 pi integral of lambda epsilon alpha epsilon mu nu. If I look at this term, you see if I do the integrals, right, let me define this to be S winding. This term. Then if I calculate S winding, this ends up being something like some integer NA times theta B plus NB theta A. The A and B stand for the two cycles of my torus. And this NA is the winding of lambda, right? So I can define this as being like the integral of lambda, integral d lambda along one of those cycles. Okay. Right, since I have this epsilon mu nu in there, you see that I have the d a nu, if I integrate, I can integrate it by parts. I flip the d over onto the lambda. And then you see if I integrate A along, say, the time cycle, then I get the other integral, the integral over the space cycle, integrates D of lambda along the space cycle. And then this 2 pi out here is chosen in such a way that I get a nice meaningful integer out for this NA, right? NA as winds by 2 pi around the circle, I divide it by 2 pi, so I just get an integer. So this NA and NB are sitting in the integers. And then basically this Pearson integral d lambda, you should think of includes the sum over all these winding sectors in A and B. If I want to do Pearson integral over all configurations of my lambda field, then I should include a sum over all the non-trivial topologies, sum over all these different winding numbers that my Lagrange multiplier can have around those circles. And then basically my S winding becomes a discrete delta function that enforces, in fact, that theta A is equal to theta B. Okay, so to recap what we accomplished, right, we have like an integral d phi of my original action, which was an action only of phi, became equal to some integral d phi dA d. Now let me call this phi tilde, which was kind of my Lagrange multiplier from before. If some e to the minus s bar, the s bar is the original s that I had with kind of my d phi replaced by a d mu phi, then we added this I over 2 pi integral of phi tilde epsilon mu nu d mu. So this is an exact identity, right? I took my scalar field, I introduced a new gauge field, I impose the delta function that says that new gauge field is zero, and that delta function got rewritten as a Lagrange multiplier lambda, which enforces this constraint that there's no dynamics in the gauge field. So this right-hand side with three fields is exactly the same as the left-hand side. Okay. Now our second step is gonna be, we integrate out, right? We do the integral d phi and we do the integral d a mu, and then we get some dual action of phi tilde. And the key insight in here is that the action is quadratic. Both phi and A show up, well, in my original action, that was quadratic. So that's quadratic in phi and quadratic in A. And then A shows up one more time in here, that's linear. So when I say quadratic, I mean it's at best quadratic. Right? If I look every single term in my action, it at best involves two phi's, two A's, there's a term that's linear in A. So this is a Gaussian integral. I can actually do this integral. And when we do Gaussian integrals, that's basically equivalent, and I wanted to work this out in more detail, but I surely don't have time for this. It's equivalent for kind of solving the classical equations of motion and plugging in. Okay, when you want to do a Gaussian integral with a linear term, the way you usually do this is you complete the square, which means you need to sort of shift your variables a little bit, you write something as a perfect square. That gives me Gaussian integral, it gives me a bunch of pi's, that's a prefactor that I'm gonna ignore. But the important thing is when I shifted this, I get some constant out front and e to the minus s by how much I shifted. And that shift term, that's the only one we care about. And that ends up being exactly the same as solving the equations of motion for a rigid action and evaluating the action on the solution of the equations of motion. If this sounds unfamiliar to you, just try it out. I write down something quadratic linear, do your shifting of variables to complete the square, and then you see that leftover term is exactly the same as the action evaluated in the solution of the equations of motion. So when we do these Gaussian integrals, in the end, we just do classical. So you can work out the equations of motion of this action quite easily, right? You find your equations of motion, tell me something that r squared over 4 pi times A1 is equal to I over 2 pi times D2 phi tilde, and the other way around, R squared over 4 pi of A2 is equal to minus I over 2 pi E1 of phi tilde. And you plug this back in, and you get, in fact, this action S tilde, which is going to just be an integral 1 over 4 pi integral of R tilde squared over 2 phi tilde. And that's indeed is telling you that R tilde is just equal to 2. So you can explicitly derive this duality by doing formal personical manipulations where you just introduce dummy variables, you integrate out the original variables, and the action in terms of the dummy variables is just the T dual action. Notes. Why did I do this? Right? So this was some rather trivial theory. But the reason we start with a trivial theory is because for this trivial theory, you can actually just do these personicals. There's nothing mysterious about duality. Duality is just somehow calculating the same personical using different variables. And we made sure it's the same personical by doing this procedure, where we make it a bigger integral and integrate out one or the other field first. Okay, so here comes the real meat, the things I'm not going to explicitly calculate, but no, what's so interesting about this? But first of all, you should note, we can do this for many other dualities. And these are all sort of free dualities so that I can actually do this explicitly. One of them was mentioned yesterday, right? If I, for example, have an action where if I write this in form notation, I have some action where I have some sort of higher form gate fields, something where I get something like this, so P, equals to zero, this would just be a scalar in 2D. But then P equals to one could, for example, be like a Maxwell field. In 2D, but it could be the scalar that I wrote down before. P equals to one would be a Maxwell. P equals to two would be like a gauge field with two indices. And this H, which is sort of a derivative, H has two indices. And then this D, it's like a field strength with three indices of a gauge field with two indices. And so if you have a theory like this, you can kind of take like a personical dh and you kind of replace it with a personical df. Yeah, this thing I would call f. And I have a field strength which has three indices. Instead of integrating over the gauge field, I integrate over the field strength. You go into Maxwell's theory and say, instead of doing a personical over the vector potential A mu, I want to do personical over the field strength F mu. This sounds crazy. You shouldn't do this, right? What's wrong with this? Think about it for a few seconds, right? What's wrong with this is that this variable is not unconstrained, right? This one obeys a Bianchi identity. But I know that DF gotta be equals to zero, right? Anything like a field strength that I made out of d mu a mu minus d mu a mu, that field strength automatically obeys two of the Maxwell's equations, right? It obeys this equation, which in form notation you write as df equals to zero. This is not an unconstrained field. So if I want to make sure that this is right, I can introduce some Lagrange multiplier lambda, and I get some e to the I, some integral that imposes my Bianchi identity. So instead of integrating the gauge field, you integrate the field strength together with a Lagrange multiplier that enforces the Bianchi identity. And then again, you can kind of do the integral df. You get a dual Syrian action for this lambda. If you chase this through, but this basically takes a p form into d minus p minus one form. So p goes into d minus p minus one. Now, in particular, you could kind of take in 2D, you can take a scalar into a scalar. So this would be another way of deriving t-duality without introducing three fields. You could have just done it as two fields. But if I say do this in 3D, you can show that a vector is dual to a compact scalar. If you take Maxwell's theory in 2+1 dimensions, you run through this duality that I just described, you get a theory of a compact scalar. And this was mentioned in the last duality lecture as kind of, yeah, if you have like a gauge field in 2+1, you can rewrite this as a compact scalar. That would be one way of actually accomplishing this. In 4D, it would basically give you E and M duality, right? A vector turns into a vector, and essentially you kind of mix place the gauge fields with the dual gauge fields, the one where like whether the electric field or the magnetic field was written in terms of easily in terms of your vector potential gets exchanged by this. So this is another example where you can use the same technique of doing exact Parsonical indent identities in a series of Gaussian Parsonicals to derive a nice thing. This was my one note. The other note is we can also use this for interacting theory, for some interacting theory. And this is the main reason why I did this with the gauging and exploiting the shift symmetry, rather than doing it the way with only one auxiliary fields. And the advantage here is that with the symmetry that you can say apply this to some action which looks something like this, right? I still have my d mu phi, d nu phi. But what I'm now gonna do is I multiply this with some function d mu nu, which itself can be a function of phi's. And then if you want, you can also do some other function, d mu nu phi, which is also multiplying d nu phi, but this one would be symmetric. This one would be anti-symmetric. So, and then you can do something fancy like, yes, some function big phi of my phi's, which couples to the curvature of this two-dimensional spacetime, like essentially Ferrucci. And so this is basically saying I have an interacting theory where I have terms like phi to some power e phi squared. Right? So these are interacting. Right? These are interaction terms now in my 2D action. But the important thing is if I go in and replace d phi with covariant d phi, my action is still quadratic in the A's. So a lot of the tools that I can do that I indicated before, you can still do by the same techniques. Maybe I wasn't, when I said I just do classical equations of motion, we have a gauge symmetry. So I can always go ahead and sort of gauge fix phi equals to zero. And then I can the Parsonical over dA, that's doable. So in the end, I get some dual action, this new mu nu tilde, mu two tilde. So now we wrote down some non-trivial interacting theory where we can derive an exact Parsonical identity. Where the interaction terms, this d mu nu encodes an infinite number of these power series terms and large series of terms, which are interaction terms in this two-dimensional quantum field theory. I can write down a different quantum field theory which has completely different interaction terms. They have this G mu nu tilde. And that's equivalent, and you can exactly prove that's equivalent at the level of a personal identity by doing this explicit manipulations. But in terms of string theory, what you did, like in the target space, you found some circle because I still need this shift symmetry. And somewhere in your complicated geometry, this G mu nu could be like a metric on your target space. You found some circle and you changed that circle to like a circle which has the inverse size 2/R. So you're changing a geometry which is kind of a circle fibered in a non-trivial way over some manifold. And you locally invert the size of the circle, and that gives you some completely new geometry. If you have some string theorists in your department who get really excited about mirror symmetry and Calabi-Yau and all sorts of things, that's basically what they're doing. They're studying this trivial duality of a 2D quantum field theory, which you can derive exactly by passing by. Okay, there's some relation of this to fermionization, bosonization, but I think Chong has covered this excellently. I wanted to move on to cyber duality in order to tell you something a little bit more modern from the 90s, which connects much more closely to what did people do in 2+1. But here my goal was to try to tell you sometimes these dualities can explicitly be derived, and they're really personal identities, changing variables in integral, and sometimes they can be useful. Maybe I should quickly stop for questions before I move on to part two of my talk. Brandon, do you have any questions that I should address?
Yeah, Andreas, there is some question about the periodicity of phi and a mu. Let me just read Rehua's question. So when integrating out phi and a mu, it seems that whether they're periodic are not important in using the equation of motion and so on. So I'm a bit confused how to take their periodicity into account appropriately, or are they just not important in this procedure?
Okay, so phi, I basically just, this is what I said in the end here. The way we do it, so we do an integral over phi and a, and we want to do this integral explicitly, but I also impose this gauge invariance, right? My a is, their gauge transformations acting on phi and a. So I need, the way I deal with the gauge invariance, I fix a gauge. One way to fix the gauge is to set phi equals to zero. So phi is just gone and its periodicity is not important. A mu is not a periodic field, right? A mu is a real field that takes all possible values. So I exactly do this personal over A mu and cluster of this classical equations of motion. But what's important is that I needed this periodicity in the new field, the phi tilde, in order to set all the Wilson lines to zero. So the periodicity of phi tilde is required so that even on a non-trivial space-time, on a torus or a cylinder, I still get that this auxiliary action with the three fields is equivalent to the original action plus with the phi tilde.
Okay, thanks. And there's also a related question from Pierre Fromholtz. Would allowing the Lagrange multiplier to wind regenerate the Wilson lines, but not the field string?
So the Lagrange multiplier winding, all these winding numbers is what's required to set the Wilson lines to zero, right? We had this in my personal, there was a sum of all the windings, and that sum of all the windings imposes the discrete delta function that set the Wilson lines to zero. We can talk about this maybe more later. I want to move on to cyber duality. Thank you for your questions. Let's try to move on to part two.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Brandon. So my second example of a duality where we can actually do something, but much less, is going to be cyber duality. But this is going to look much closer to what people do in 2+1 dimensions. Okay. Right, so T duality is almost too good to be true. It's true, but too good to be useful, right? So I shouldn't say too good to be true, right? It's too good to be kind of interesting. It does some things, but it's a free theory, right? Cyber duality is actually an interacting theory. It's one of the few examples where we have really solid understanding of how duality works. Let me write down the basic statement. Then what I want to teach you about cyber duality is how do you check some of those claims, right? So here's the claim. You take sort of a gauge theory, S and F minus NC plus NF flavors. I wrote it the wrong way. Okay, that's equivalent to a gauge theory, which is S and C plus NF flavors. Right, these flavors, this is sort of matter fields in the fundamental representation. What sort of matter fields, bosons or fermions, don't I care? Well, it's supersymmetric, they're both. Right, yeah, so this is, you can think of this as basically QCD, right? If SU, if it's NC is 3 and NF is like 6 or however proxy you want to study, then it's like, I have an SU3 gauge group, and I have a bunch of quarks that interact with it, which are in the fundamental representation. But we generalize this to SUN, CN, and F, so we can see meaningful patterns. So already, if you look at this, you see this is really, really interesting, because if you have like this old fashioned particle physicists to go on to you, like symmetry is so important in the universe, like the basic principle that dominates all of particle physics is that the gauge group of the standard model is SU3 times SU2 times U1. Those symmetries define our universe. That's kind of bollocks, right? These are gauge groups. They're gauge symmetries aren't physical. Nobody, no physical degree of freedom is transforming under a gauge symmetry. And now here we see if we change variables on a gauge theory, you can kind of completely change the theory, right? A theory with 8 gluons is completely equivalent to a theory with NF minus 3 squared minus 1 gluons, right? The number of gluons has nothing to do with the physics of the universe. It's just a particular set of variables we are using in order to describe the universe. It's not global symmetries are something fundamental, but gauge symmetries are just redundancies of our description. And we have examples where I can rewrite my Parsnickels new variables where like the gauge symmetries that make up my theory, there's nothing fundamental here, right? If you were to kind of make a big deal about SENC being fundamental, then you suddenly would be really aghast that somebody tells you I can write on the same theory without ever seeing SUNC in my theory whatsoever. So I think for many people who love quantum field theory, like Seiberg reality was really eye-opening in that in principle we knew this gauge symmetries are redundancies, yada yada yada. But this put it in your face, right? No, you can just use different variables in the gauge symmetries completely. So what I want to talk with you about today is kind of how do we know this is true? Because these tools are the ones that people use in 2+1 dimensions as well. And what do I even mean by true? Seiberg duality, unlike what I wrote down before, is an IR duality. Right? And what we're having here, I have a theory A and I have a theory B. This is going to call electric and magnetic. And kind of this theory B can be, you know, in the UV, it's not the same as theory A, but then I do some sort of RG flow. Then I get the same theory in the IR. You might say, hey, this is just, no, you write down universality. Isn't this what we studied all along and you're doing something really boring? Wilson invented this like way before Nadi ever got into the game. But no, the new thing here is that when we do standard RG flow, we would usually, you write down a Lagrange and you have a set of operators and the coupling constant of this operator scales. You fixed your field, you fixed your degrees of freedom. And then the only thing that you're writing down is like, how might do my interaction terms change as a function of scale? What we have here is that theory A and B, they have completely different degrees of freedom, right? It's much more exciting than just scaling a bunch of coupling constants down as, you know, seeing how they scale as you change energies. We have two theories which are different in UV, they're the same in the IR. And sometimes we'll see it can happen that like, you know, B is, for example, a free theory. And A is not. So you have like a theory A is say weakly coupled in the UV, but it becomes strongly coupled in the IR. B is weakly coupled all along, something like this, or maybe B was strongly coupled in the UV and then becomes weakly coupled in the IR. So even so, I'm just saying I'm rewriting my Parsnickel in two different ways. What this is really saying is writing down this reality is identifying the correct low energy degrees of freedom. It's a little bit like doing the Fermi liquid theory. You have some interacting mess, but in the IR, you find some new quantum particles. Basically, writing down theory B is like identifying the correct degrees of freedom in the IR, if B happens to be free in the IR, which it sometimes will be in this example. I need to tell you a little bit about the phase structure of the theory before I can study interactions. And right, so the most important thing if I want to understand like a non-Abelian gauge theory in 3+1 dimensions is write down the beta function. People get Nobel Prizes for things like this. So my beta function, I write down minus g cubed over 16 pi squared times some coefficient b zero. And then you've probably seen many times this b zero is kind of 11/3 times the index of the adjoint because that's what that comes from the vectors. And then I get mu scalar divided by 6 by the real scalars minus 2/3 mu fermion, where these are viable fermions. In this mu is basically this quadratic index is something like a trace the ATB. An important thing for me is mu is equal to 1/2 for the fundamental and mu is equal to n for the adjoint. Then we are starting a SUSY theory, right? So when I have an AMU, it comes with a lambda. And when I have a quark, it comes with a scalar partner phi. So if I plug this in, you see that my B0 is equal to like my NC times n thirds from vector minus the 2/3 because it has a fermion body. Then my meta fields, I have an F of them and always come with a complex scalar. So that's a 1/3 plus a fermion, 2/3. And then you see this becomes much prettier. This is 3NC minus an F. So magic of SUSY is make 1/3 disappear. It can do much more else in addition, but at least if you write on beta functions, you don't have to deal with this weird factors of a third anymore. The spirit is the same, right? If beta function was minus B0, so if B0 is positive, the beta function is negative, asymptotically free, free in the UV, strongly interacting the IR. That's sort of where interesting physics happens. If you put enough flavors in there, if you make an F bigger than 3NC, the theory becomes free in the IR, you know, ill-defined in the UV. That's the sort of thing Central has been studying the series to test recently. But usually in particle physics, we're interested in the case where an F is less than 3, so we have an asymptotically free series. If I write on the phase structure of the theory, this is NF as a function of NC. There's 3NC here. I hit a free theory. And then the rest is really, really complicated. Right? There's a claim and that once you hit 3/2 over NC, that in between here, the theory actually becomes conformal. And down here, it's a mess. Confining. We can still understand it. Nardi has everything under control, but I will not talk about this today. The interesting thing is if you write down the dual theory, right, then you kind of write down NF being 3/2, and you will understand soon why I wrote down this vector, right? So my dual theory was NF minus NC, right? So I want to ask myself what happens when, and I can call this NC tilde. What happens when F hits like 3/2 NC, right? And you see that 3/2 NC is exactly, when I want to ask myself, when is NF equals to 3 NC tilde, right? I would get an equation which is telling that NF is equal to 3 NF minus 3 NC, or that's saying that NF is equal to 3/2 NC. So this is telling me if I go to the left, actually here my theory will become free in the IR. If I decrease the number of flavors, my magnetic theory will become free in the IR. And then this 3 NC here is exactly when this theory turns into a confining mess. So if you basically say there's something called the Banks-Zaks fixed point, where if I'm close to 3 NC, this theory is weakly coupled. I can take some large N limit where this is precise. But right, if I go towards the border where my theory just is about to lose asymptotic freedom, turn into some boring free theory in the IR, that theory is weakly coupled. Whereas over here, that theory becomes weakly coupled at this end. So if I look at this only at this regime, people call this a conformal window where my theory hits a conformal fixed point. The electric theory becomes more and more weakly coupled as I go to bigger NF. The magnetic theory becomes more and more weakly coupled as I go to smaller NF. That's a weak, strong duality in the sense that there are windows where one of them is weak. If you're sitting somewhere in the middle, you're screwed no matter what. This is a strongly coupled theory. Sorry, there's nothing you can do about it. You still have a nice personal identity that they're both giving me the same degrees of freedom. But now say if I wanted to study the theory over here, where I say it's a confining mess, God knows what's going on. Well, this is what's going on. Somehow your quarks and gluons confine to some composite particles. And those composite particles are free gluons and free quarks of a different gauge group. This is pretty fascinating stuff, right? Yeah. This is really, really useful. It completely identifies for you what is this confining mess. In the electric side, it's a bunch of free degrees of freedom on the dual side. What I wanted to tell you in maybe 10 minutes, so we have some time for questions in the end, is why is this true? But not why is this true? How do we know this is true? Right. First, you should ask yourself, how do people come up with this duality? I know you have to either be a genius, work for one of us, Or there would have been a technique which I do not have enough time to tell you about, where you use your brains and, you know, do this by doing something called the Hanani-Witten construction. Okay, I already admit I will not get there. But let's say this, you know, fell from the sky, somebody handed you this duality and says, this is a true duality, believe me. Here's what you would do in order to kind of check that they're not completely crazy. So one thing you can do, and this is the thing that I will not explain, you can explicitly check that certain operators match. And this requires soothing magic. So don't think like these checks that I'm about to give you, which may sound rather weak, are all there is. There's much more to this. If you have supersymmetry, you can't solve the theory exactly, at least with this little supersymmetry, you can't solve the theory exactly. But there's certain operators whose dimensions, right? This is a conformal field theory. The interesting data is operators, their dimensions, their correlation functions. There are certain operators whose dimensions you actually have control over. They're called BPS operators. And you can confirm they're the same on both sides. That's pretty cool. I'm not going to talk about this. The two things I will talk about with you are anomalies and deformations. Why those two things? Because this should look really familiar. This is exactly what people do in 2+1 dimensions when they advertise these 2+1 dimension dualities. These are sort of the things they do. You saw, you know, phase diagrams of where you deform like two series, you go into like the same phases, that's deformations. There wasn't much talk about anomalies, but anomalies is a really crucial ingredient you can check in order to make sure the two series are the same. And I want to tell you about this in the 3+1 dimensional setting, because that's much simpler than the 2+1. There are much fewer subtleties. You, instead of dealing with discrete gauge groups and, you know, you just discrete symmetries, we just do continuous symmetries and calculate a bunch of numbers, and we're really stunned that those numbers are the same on both sides. So these are the two tools I want to focus on and tell you how this works for this particular case. So right, to study anomalies, we have to write down the matter content of the theory. So let me write down the electric theory very quickly. How does this electric theory look like? I have some scalars Q, I have some scalars psi, and then these are flavors come with kind of left and right-handed fields, and I have my fermions that came with the gauge field, and I have an A mu. Right, and then I have my SUNC, that's my gauge group. And then I have a flavor symmetry that rotates the left-handed gauge fermions, a flavor symmetry rotates the right-handed fermions. Then I have a U1A, which is anomalous, as we'll soon see, so it shouldn't have written it even. I have a U1B, and then I have a U1R. This is an R, you can't read this again. Let me just call it big R, and it's even. Okay, so the left-handed fields transform under this one, the right-handed fields transform under this one. These are all fundamentals, these are anti-fundamentals. This is an adjoint, and this is an adjoint. And then I can have like these, the flavor, I can have UNFs left and right, so I can assign, instead of the U1s writing them left and right, I can have one that's plus one for both, and I have one that's plus one, minus one, minus one. So that's a lot of, you know, a vector and an axial U1 symmetry, and my, you know, gauge field and its fermion body, they're all neutral under this. And so far I made sure that, like, you know, a scalar and a fermion that belong together because SUDI makes them love each other. Now, those have the same charges under everything, but as a quantum field theory, there's no reason Qs and psis have to always pick up the same phases. That's what this R is about. In supersymmetric theories, you have like all these global symmetries which treat like SUDI multiplets all on one footing. And then the R symmetry is the one that allows fermions and scalars or fermions and vectors in a given multiplet to transform differently. So my gauge field always gonna be neutral. And then under the R symmetry, we give the gauge eno charge one. Then if you give the scalar some charge RQ, this one has RQ minus one. And then there's some C2 symmetry, which just tells me that those guys also have to have RQ and RQ minus one. So fermions and scalars always differ, they are charged by one, but they have the same charge under all the others. Okay, so what is now about these anomalies that I was trying to tell you about? In a 3+1 dimensional quantum field series, my anomalies come from triangle diagrams like this. And they end up being non-zero, right? So this is telling me there's some current J mu that there's some coefficient, which is basically proportional to something like the trace of three generators. And you know, the commutator is the taken out. There's some intercommutated at times. F mu nu, F rho sigma, some epsilon mu nu, some sort of instanton density that's made out of the field strength. Now, what's the status of something like this is depends a little bit on whether this J and this F belong to global or local symmetries. But if both of them belong to a local symmetry, so L stands for local, G is for global. If both of those belong to local symmetries, then your theory goes into the trash. If this coefficient is not zero, why? You needed the current to be conserved so that your theory is gauge invariant. Gauge invariance was one of the defining features of your theory. You modeled out your personal by gauge transformations, but suddenly the current is not conserved because F mu nu, even if you know this is a gauge field, a dynamical field, you can't set F mu nu to zero. You have to sum over sectors where like instanton numbers is non-vanishing. Your current is not conserved, your theory is gauge invariant, throw it away. If you the current you're looking at is global, but your field strength is local, then it's just not a symmetry. It is telling me generically, I study field configuration where the right-hand side is non-zero. You saw there's a symmetry, it's just not there. The current isn't conserved. And that's what's happening for our U1. But the really interesting thing is that both of them are global. And that goes by this name of the Toft anomaly. This is now telling me, there's a number I can calculate. It does nothing bad to my theory. This is a real global symmetry. If I were to gauge that global symmetry, the current would no longer be conserved. The theory would be inconsistent. If I turn on background gauge field for that global symmetry current, the current suddenly is no longer conserved. But if I don't do anything, that's a perfectly fine global symmetry. The reason Toft anomalies are so exciting is because they have to match on both sides of the duality. Because you can run the following argument, right? The theory by itself, I can't gauge this global symmetry, but I can put extra matter that cancels the global anomaly, the Toft anomaly, and then the theory can be consistently gauged. And if I take two theories which are supposed to be dual, if I know I can add a certain matter on the left-hand side and consistently gauge the global symmetry, I know in the dual theory that gotta be the case too. Unless this number, this result of this triangle diagram, which is just really saying, add up these numbers, trace the ATP DC on both sides, I get a non-trivial number, that number has to agree on both sides, otherwise the theory can't possibly be good. And it's a pity that I've been so slow because I really wanted to calculate one of those numbers for you. But let me just show you kind of how stunning this is. You can calculate these anomalies for every global symmetry and for every payoff. So you can also have mixed generators, take two SUNF generators and one U1R generator. Right? You can calculate these numbers for both theories and you find like stunning agreement between the electric and the magnetic side.
Andreas, let me heads up that you have 10 minutes.
Yeah, perfect. I'm getting there. But I just wanted to write down, like on the electric side, the U1R cube, I just called it R, the R cube. And normally that's almost the last thing I'm gonna do, but then I kind of briefly touch upon deformation that all be done in 5 minutes. And so if you wanted to calculate this U1R cube anomaly, right? So I say it's a generator, a trace of three generators. It really just means add up the charges cube of all the fields, right? So we had these tri-fields, right? They had charge, I called it R cube, but no, the anomaly free R symmetry is something like minus NC over NF is the charge for this size. I have to cube this and have NF of those fields. They come with NC colors. Then I multiply it times two because of the psi and the psi tildes, right? Both the fundamentals and the anti-fundamentals. And on top of this, I have these gay genos. I have n squared minus one of them, and they have charge one. So whether I cube this or not is exactly the same to me. Right? So this is not a trivial number. And I didn't write down the magnetic theory for you, but if you were to do the same calculation on the magnetic side, you have these magnetic quarks. It's easy to check that their R charge has to be something like this. I also multiply them times two. Then on the magnetic side, there are some singlet fields, which I didn't even talk about, but the duality is a little bit more complicated than what I made it out to be. There are some gauge singlets on the magnetic side, which transform like something like this. And then you have the magnetic gluons. They have this many of those times one cube. And this doesn't look the same, but you can give this to a high school student who's studied algebra 2. They spend 10 minutes and they can confirm to you that those two expressions are the same. And you have numbers like this agreeing on both sides. and then you get you buy the duality, right? This is sort of you do like a list of like 10 calculations like this, where these numbers seem to have absolutely nothing to do on both sides and they completely agree with each other. That's a fascinating check that you can do in the 3+1 dimension series. In 2+1, you can still check off the anomalies, but it's often much more subtle than this, right? Once you go into like higher form symmetries, discrete symmetries, it's no longer as easy as just adding up a bunch of numbers cube. But this is one of the stunning checks you can do in Seebeck. The other one I wanted to talk about is deformations. And I'll cut this very short. But right, one thing I can do is I can add a mass term. Basically, what this is going to do is take NF to NF minus 1. On the dual side, you see there's a potential term, which I also didn't tell you about. That potential term has the feature that it, if I add a mass term, it will force a Higgsing. And it basically takes this NC tilde into NC tilde minus 1, right? NC tilde was like NF minus NC. So that goes into NF minus NC minus 1. And in addition, NF also went to NF minus 1. And then you see those two things are consistent with each other, right? On the original side, all I did is I get rid of one flavor, I reduced NF. But on the dual side, the dual NC was given by NF minus NC. But indeed, I get a spontaneous, I get a Higgs mechanism, which breaks NF minus NC down to NF minus 1 minus NC and also gets rid of a flavor. So you can check that your duality is self-consistent, it reproduces itself if you add deformations on both. That's all I had to say, all I got to. I had way more prepared, but these online lectures take longer than I had hoped for. I hope I conveyed to you at least this picture that out of the particle physics community, this is where we get our intuition from. And there are these very nice realities, like where you can exactly do particle manipulations and prove them, or where you can kind of easily do these checks that we love so much, where you use anomalies and deformations in order to kind of make sure that you're whatever guess you had for a duality is heading in the right direction. It was very easy to guess these dualities in the supersymmetric case. It's much harder to do this in non-supersymmetric cases, but the tools people develop in supersymmetry, they should still be applicable even in the non-supersymmetric cases. Right, I yield the remaining 2 minutes of my time for questions.
Okay, thanks Andreas for the nice lecture. And thanks also for leaving some time for a couple questions. There are some hands raised. Umang can ask the question.
Hi, am I audible?
Yes.
I can hear you, yes.
Are these Seebeck dualities for supersymmetric theories in any way related to the Bose-Fermi dualities in Chern-Simons matter theories?
Yes. What you can do is you can give like masses to say this. Right here, my matter is like I have fundamentals which are scalars and fermions, and these both Fermi dualities have one or the other. So what you can do is you kind of go in, take the supersymmetric theory, and add a supersymmetry breaking mass. You add a mass to one of those fields and not the other. So then you need to follow the RG flow, right? I started with a CFT, which was a supersymmetric CFT. I add a relevant deformation. I end up with a new CFT. So the question is, can you keep track of that flow? The claim is, if I go to large N, I actually can, or I can't, but some people can, Shirazman Valla and others. Like, people are really good at doing calculations like this. At large N can do these calculations. It can verify that at large N, first off, there's Seebeck dualities in 3+1, but there are also Seebeck dualities in 2+1. So if you compactify Seebeck down from 3+1 to 2+1, you get a supersymmetric duality that has all the same checks that I gave you in 3+1. Then you deform it, and then the real question is, can you follow the RG flow at large? And you can see the supersymmetric Seebeck descends to these both Fermi dualities in the large N case. If you go all the way to N equals to 1, there we get these beautiful pictures of duality maps, then you can do so too with a lot of hand-waving. Shamit Kahu and his collaborators, they basically, they can't track the RG flow, but they can argue by uniqueness. The only thing, assuming that nothing dramatically happens, the only thing if you follow like a supersymmetric pair up on the UV, the only thing that you can end up with is the supersymmetric pair in the IR. So it's believed that they are connected to each other by mass deformation. So this is to some extent another check that goes along these lines here, where you can deform your series by supersymmetric breaking relevant deformations and then reproduce bosonization values in 2+1 from CD pair.
I see. Thank you.
Any other questions? I have a question connecting to Chong's talk yesterday. So regarding this fermion boson duality, are there manipulations that can be done at the level of the partition function, maybe approximate, that allow you to see this duality Chong mentioned yesterday?
But people have a lattice version of it, right? So you're on the lattice, you can do it like prove an exact equivalence.
Mm-hmm.
Theory of a boson in the fermion that looks a lot like what you want to get in the continuum. If you do this in the lattice, then the question is, if you go to the continuum, do you actually get those theories as advertised, right? I think Chong also alluded to this. It's easy to prove a duality on the lattice where it's sort of, it's an exact manipulation that gets you from one side to the other one. Whether this gives the continuum theories that we all believe it should give is because these are complicated things to go. What you can do is if you assume the duality works and write it as a personal identity, then you can derive these duality webs, right? You can write, you get partition functions which aren't just numbers like I pretended they are here, but they depend on values of background fields. Then you can kind of say, here's a personal identity where I now treat my partition function as a function of background fields as an integrand for a new personal. And kind of integrate over what used to be background fields, you can derive lots of new dualities from old dualities. So assuming that all these personal integral manipulations are well defined, you can generate this whole duality web. So there's like infinite number of dualities you get out of this one basic statement of the Bose-Fermi duality. But the Bose-Fermi duality, nobody has an exact personal derivation in the continuum. There's something like it on the lattice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, yeah, I think now's a good time to break. So let's virtually thank Andreas and Brandon, and we'll resume in about 15 minutes.